leaflets in Pashto, Dari, and English that read, "The Taliban are using civilian areas to hide their equipment, endangering everyone in the area. Flee any area where military equipment or personnel are located." 7. All tribal allies should identify primary and secondary targets for their planned ground assault. 8. All assets should identify possible escape routes out of Afghanistan for UBL and other AQ leaders, followed by reconnaissance of the routes for interdiction. We knew historically that in irregular warfare, the chances of killing or capturing specific enemy leaders were not great, so we wanted contingency plans in place. 9. Prepare for the interrogation and exploitation of prisoners. 10. Assess humanitarian needs. In closing, I wrote, "We are fighting for the CT, counterterrorism, objectives in the Afghan theater, and although this sets high goals in very uncertain, shifting terrain, we are also fighting for the future of CIA, DOD, integrated counterterrorism warfare around the globe. While we will make mistakes as we chart new territory and new methodology, our objectives are clear and our concept of partnership is sound." I instructed our CIA liaison in Tampa to share the entire message with General Franks and his staff. From the beginning, I was working in a barely bounded rage. I lashed out whenever somebody failed to meet expectations. I had fired several people from CTCSO, including one veteran CIA paramilitary officer and a CENTCOM liaison officer. I had castigated almost everybody at some point, in private and public. My anger was driven by fear, honor, and pride. I was afraid of another massive attack in our homeland. I was afraid that our men would be slaughtered. But I was most afraid of mission failure. What trumped fear, however, was a burning need for retribution rooted in a sense of shameful violation. AQ had breached our shores, killed thousands of our people in New York, bombed our nation's military headquarters, and sought to attack our nation's capital, only to be thwarted by brave passengers of United Airlines Flight 93. My life's ambition was to protect our citizens and advance our nation's interests, and now this? But even more than base retribution, this was a time and opportunity to restore the honor and pride of our nation and our agency. I had told our teams this before they departed, that they were the vanguard of our country's response. They were afforded the honor of seeking retribution, restoring our pride, and protecting our citizens from other attacks. Our nation needed them more than ever. I was fiercely proud of them, those downrange and those in HQS, from Dick Holm, the oldest, to Will Hurd, the youngest. Dick was a senior advisor who had led CIA tribal allies in Southeast Asia during the Vietnam War. He had been horribly burned in a helicopter crash in the Congo, but many days later walked out of the jungle and spent the next 30 years rising through the ranks of the clandestine service. He had retired but was now back, on contract, working as a senior advisor in CTCSO. Will Hurd was a 22-year-old African-American from San Antonio who had just joined the CIA as a CT. He showed up in the very first days of CTCSO. I didn't know where he came from or how he got there. We made him the runner gopher. He was superb. After his stint with CTCSO, he would serve for more than a decade in the clandestine service, running counter-terrorist and cyber operations in South Asia. Our collective, channeled, disciplined emotional response was as important as the strategy we had forged. Without the will to win, strategy is moot. We all intuitively understood this. This concept, of course, was nothing new. More than 2,000 years ago, Thucydides emphasized the paramount importance of understanding and harnessing the passions of men at war. It was Sunday morning, 7 October 2001, with only a couple of hours to go before the air campaign commenced. Our teams were prepared. In our HQS office, the staff was at full stride, cranking out intelligence and imagery in support of our teams, our military partners, and our Afghan allies. It was controlled, determined mayhem. Massey pulled me aside and asked, "Are you okay with this?" "Am I okay with this? What is he thinking? I've waited to do this for years. The time is now, and we have no time to waste with some hand-wringing philosophical discussion." "John, I'm more than okay," I snapped. He grabbed my arm and smiled. "I'm not asking about the enemy. I'm asking about you. Have you got yourself right with the fact that we are going to be responsible for the deaths of thousands?" "They need to die," I hissed. "Yes, I know our mission, and I'll be as satisfied as you when we are victorious. But you need to realize there is a moral imperative that you cannot ignore. You should consider your immortal soul. We've run many ops, some where people have lost their lives, but nothing like this. You need to stop for a minute, reflect, and pray. You need it. Your men need it. We all need it." Leave it to John to give such elemental, personal, generous guidance when needed most and realized least. He was my deputy and friend, and also a moral compass. "Yeah, you're right." The two of us closed the door, and we prayed for a couple of minutes. We had a war waiting for us, but if we wanted God on our side, and if our salvation was of consequence, it was a critical interlude. We were about to send thousands of the enemy straight to hell, and I did not ever want to meet them there. John's intervention also offered a reference point for teaching that I would use in the years ahead, whether lecturing university students, CIA trainees, or military operators. Not a theological point, but rather an enduring lesson of warfare. You need to know yourself. The better you understand yourself, your team, and your nation, the better you can triangulate friend and foe in the human terrain of combat. Sun Tzu had taught this. I understood more than ever that gut-wrenching emotional lessons imprinted in my brain stick with me far better than lectures in a classroom or words on a page. The teachings of the ancients gained greater meaning when applied to my own hard lessons learned. I was about to learn some more. I was in the office, waiting, when Colonel Clark stuck his head in the door and gave me a thumbs up. The first wave of U.S. bombers had crossed into Afghan airspace. With unprecedented precision, the pilots, guided by our intelligence, would soon release their munitions on an unsuspecting, unprepared, arrogant, and evil enemy. Chapter 10. Afghanistan Operations. It is well that war is so terrible. We should grow too fond of it. Robert E. Lee. The air attack was devastating. Starting on 7 October 2001, U.S. pilots wiped out most of the AQ Taliban fixed targets in 3 days, including their antiquated anti-aircraft systems. The enemy's barracks, command control centers, storage depots, and bunkers were smoldering ruins. Many of the enemy's frontline operational units had been obliterated. We emphasized AQ command control centers and foreign fighters. They suffered the most. By the fourth day, the Pentagon was complaining to us about the lack of available bombing sites. They demanded more intelligence on more fixed conventional targets. We explained that was not possible because they were all gone. This exchange underscored the huge gap between how DOD wanted to fight and how we needed to fight. While CENTCOM and the Joint Special Operations Command, JSOC, were adapting, Some Pentagon leaders held on to their old paradigm of state-on-state war. They saw victory in terms of destruction of fixed sites and standing armies. They searched for a geographic center of gravity on the battlefield, failing to understand that the center of gravity rested in the minds of the Afghans. There were four reasons for such a fast and comprehensive air campaign. First, these conventional targets were limited in number. Afghanistan, one of the most undeveloped countries in the world, also had one of the most undeveloped defense systems. From a conventional perspective, Afghanistan offered a dearth of big infrastructure targets to destroy. Second, the enemy's old and dilapidated anti-aircraft defense was pathetic, posing limited threat to the world's most modern air force. Third, the U.S. strikes were the most precise in the history of warfare because of advances in technology and skills. Fourth, the pilots knew exactly where to strike because of the extraordinarily exact